As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Austria MotoGP has given Pecco Bagnaia and Ducati their third win on the bounce as they come out of Assen, Silverstone, and the Red Bull Ring. The Italian has cut 47 points out of Fabio Quartararo's championship lead in those three Grand Prix. So now with 32 points back from Quartararo to Aleix Espargaró and 44 back to Bagnaia, well, the race is on with still 175 points still on the table. However, it's not all doom and gloom for Quartararo as he rode the race of his life to finish second in the Austrian Grand Prix, cutting through the defence of Jack Miller, who trailed Bagnaia for much of the race. Toby Moody here with Simon Patterson, Valentin Hrunci to talk Austria 2022. And later on, I'll put in my thoughts of the Sprint GP that was announced at the weekend. Apologies if my sound is a little bit different. I'm away on holiday for this week, but great to watch the race and great to catch up with these guys for this podcast. First off, Bagnaia, his fifth win of the year. Simon, Val, who's going to go first? I am just in awe now of how Bagnaia is working utterly hand in glove with Ducati. Val.
Yeah, I think he has a real shot. And I've looked through some of the stats in the Premier class. I'm not sure I got all of them, but I think he has a real shot of this season being the rider with the most wins in history in a season not to win the title. I think that's looking quite likely now. He has five. He needs, I think, four more. Looks entirely possible. Yeah, he looks very much in tune. Honestly, I had the feeling Bagnaia was going to have this one when he lined up seconds, just because even though they talk about having no team orders, I think there's a clear focus towards Bagnaia within Ducati, and I don't think any of the other guys would have tried to make his life too difficult. And obviously, as soon as Enea dropped out because of his front wheel curb thing, yeah, that was all she wrote. I was actually a little bit surprised to see Miller even lunge at him at one point, because I thought they were just going to run in tandem and not really bother each other. But ultimately, as soon as that happened, Bagnaia responded, and soon he was gone down the road, and that was all she wrote.
Toby looked a little bit incredulous there whenever Val said that he didn't think that Pecco was going to win the title, but I'm in full agreement. I can't believe it until I see it, despite this run of form, just because the guy has been... So I'm trying to think of a polite way to say he has a tendency to absolutely fluff it when he comes under pressure. We've been in this situation before, haven't we? Where Bagnaia's went in a winning streak and it looked like everything was going to be amazing, and then it got to the crunch point and it just didn't work. Last year, whenever he crashed at Misano and threw away a championship. I'm not going to take anything away from his win on Sunday, of course, with that, because he rode an absolutely fantastic win to control the race. He got to the front. He led basically start to finish, apart from once whenever Jack showed him a wheel for a couple of corners. But, you know, it very much felt like a race where Bagnaia was in full control. He was managing the tyres, he was managing the riders behind him. And I think even though it looked at the end like Quartararo had a little bit more pace whenever he hunted him down and was sort of suddenly all over him with a few laps or with a lap to go, I think even if the race had been a few laps longer, that wouldn't have changed because I think Bagnaia probably had something in the bag. But yeah, if anything, what we saw at this weekend was testament to how well Ducati are actually working now as a group. Because it has looked really sort of fragmented and disjointed all year. And that, you know, Miller, it looked like the bike was working. It looked like Bagnaia was working. And it looked like Miller was the ultimate sort of loyal wingman all through the race, just riding tail gunner and protecting him.
Yeah, the thing is, and why I don't think he's going to win the title is that 44 points is a ton. Like, it's just a lot. I know we've already seen Bagnaia make up damn near 50 in two races, but that was a freak circumstance you really can't rely on again. Like, it could happen, but you cannot count on it.
Agreed.
And the fact of the matter is, Pecco could win every single race from here now, and if Fabio comes second in all of them, Fabio's champion. So he's gonna need help, definitely, for sure. And I don't think he's gonna win every single race left, because that's quite tough.
Ultimately, I agree that Bagnaia is not going to win the championship, because he's going to lose the championship rather than not win it, if you kind of follow, rather than fluff it up. I think that Quartararo will win it. He'll win it square. Quartararo is still riding on the top of his game. We saw it yesterday. We'll talk about it in a minute. There are 175 points still on the table, seven Grand Prix. The one thing that I can see changed in Bagnaia is he's had a bit of a wake-up call by making those silly mistakes throughout the season. He's had a wake-up call by what he did in the summer break, driving home from a nightclub. And he's probably gone home and given himself a pretty bloody good talking to, which is, this might be my only chance. It might be a Wayne Gardner championship, a Kenny Jr. championship, a Mir championship, or a Nicky Hayden championship. Some of them only win one championship. This is my opportunity, and I'm going to give it all I can so that I can sleep well come Christmas. A bit like what Jorge Martin said after the Grand Prix in Austria yesterday. You know, I had to go for the position, even though I fell off. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to sleep tonight. I just think he's changed over the last three or four Grand Prix. I agree with you, Simon. He's made some silly mistakes. But remember, at this point last year, he hadn't yet won a Grand Prix. But he has made some silly mistakes. He's just making less of them. And sooner or later, there'll be less and less. And then the top step appears.
One thing I think obliged to say at this point is, I don't think he's learned anything about from what he did wrong over the summer break. Because I don't think we've seen any real remorse or apology for the fact that he got arrested for drink driving. I don't think that has changed anything.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm still amazed that he hasn't been sanctioned by someone higher up the chain than him for that. But the thing is that regarding the mistakes on track, they always seem to come in a fairly... They always seem to come when he's under pressure. And I think at the minute, maybe because he hasn't been a championship contender, there hasn't been the pressure. It's easy to win whenever you're already out of the championship fight. And that's been the perception for a while. You know, we saw last year the only crack in that amazing run of form to end the season was on the day when Fabio could have won the championship. It was like the worst possible moment to fall off on an unforced error while leading the race. It was the worst moment to do it. Whenever you look back previously in his career, he did the same thing when he was leading his first ever race and looked set to win it. He made an unforced error and he fell off with no pressure. I say with no pressure from behind, but there was, you know, obviously pressure because the first win, mental pressure. So I think
that was then.
Yeah, but we still haven't seen that change. That's the thing. I understand what you're saying about maybe it has changed, but until we see him in those circumstances again, we can believe he maybe has changed, but I don't think we can say conclusively he's got past his demons until he's, you know, put them to bed.
Do you agree he's moved a bit? Do you agree he's changed just a bit since falling off and leading his first Grand Prix?
The thing is, I don't know, because essentially you would have said that he'd changed last year when he won, what, 4 races out of 5 and then fell off again. So there's still no pattern, you know. We've still not seen that long consistency. And then obviously, even after that amazing run of form to end last year, he had a really rocky start to this year again, to sort of knocking people off and stuff like that. So yeah, for me, there's still not enough evidence to build a sort of a new model.
Yeah, I don't think he's changed either, but I also don't think it's something that, I don't think it's something you can really fix by going into a cabin for a week and figuring himself out and getting in touch with his inner self or whatever. I don't believe that's how that works. I think it's going to change gradually with time. The more time he spends out front of MotoGP, the more time he spends, because remember, this Ducati GP22 wasn't the nicest beast for basically anyone at the start of the season. And now it is, again, the level of consistent package that the GP21 was. So I think that's the bigger change. It's just more comfortable and more confident. I don't know. It's hard to tell. Maybe there has been some intense self-reflection or something like that. But I just think it's package evolution and the evolution of the season and the fact that Pecco's still relatively new to this whole thing and still, you know, learning to run up front in MotoGP, even though he's already won many, many, many races.
The other thing that's worth remembering, he ended last year with a really strong run of form, absolutely. But he did all of his winning in Europe, because we've not really left Europe for the past 2 seasons because of COVID. But the end of this year's calendar is really, really different. We've got a lot more shook up end of the season with the return of places like Buriram, Sepang, Phillip Island, which has traditionally been somewhere where the Ducatis have really struggled and where you would expect Fabio Quartararo to be, and Aleix Espargaró and the Aprilia actually, to be at the sharp end. So I think he obviously still has a lot of work to do, and I think things are very much they're not clearly in his favour the way that they would have been if we were at this point in a calendar like last year's.
For whatever that's worth, Fabio has also done basically all of his winning in Europe, apart from one Qatar race. It's just the quirk of the...
He has, but let's not forget his end to 2019 when he maybe wasn't winning.
When
but he was
fighting
the only
Marquez,
person who could fight with Marc Marquez.
Yeah,
and that happened in the overseas races.
So remaining, Misano, Aragon, Motegi, haven't been there for a while. A lot of data, of course. People have got to find data and feeling and setup of bikes really, really quickly. Come Friday morning, Saturday morning, Thailand, Australia the same, Malaysia, Sepang, and then, of course, Valencia. That will finish the season. So, well, let's see how that one shakes out. Second position went to Fabio Quartararo. Another race that he won without actually taking the 25 points of champagne on the top step of the podium and the big trophy once he got there. What a pass into the new chicane on the way up to the third corner. Cheeky, utterly cheeky. Miller didn't see it coming, but that's the mark of a champion. Didn't seem to be too much lack of power against a Ducati around the Red Bull ring for him to be there and only finish a couple of tenths of a second back of the winner of the race. Did I also hear on the coverage that Yamaha are going to be seeking, this is what Lynn Jarvis said or something, seeking extra help from European people or such like? What news did you hear?
I think that was announced during, or referenced repeatedly during Fabio's initial contract renewal, that they have some extra European consultants on the engine side, including I think a former Ferrari Formula One staffer whose name I don't quite remember.
Engine development guy.
Yeah. Would have to Google that, and then you'd hear keys clacking and it'd be immersion braking, so we weren't going to do that. regarding the ride itself and regarding the power, I think it still was fairly clear that the power is not there, because Fabio did only do the one overtake all race, basically. So the bikes he moved ahead were the hobbled Gresini Ducati of Bastianini, Martin, who made a mistake, Maverick Vinales, who made a mistake. And then admittedly, he pulled off a absolutely fantastic overtake on Miller around the outside and inside the second part of the new chicane. And that was mega, but I don't think straight line speed had a ton to do with it. Just another...
Except the fact he finished second within half a second, Val. Come on.
Yeah, but... No, I don't think so. You look at qualifying and you see that's your answer there. Because clearly he was walking on water basically all weekend in terms of speed. He's doing absolutely everything he could. It was fantastic, Fabio, all weekend. And after, you know, a couple of off races, it's nice to see some things don't really change. He has been, those, even, you know, accounting for those mistakes, he has been head and shoulders above the best MotoGP rider this season. He still has that rider. It's true, and even watching Red Bull Ring some more, it's increasingly obvious that there's something weird going on at Yamaha, because Franco Morbidelli talks about having good vibrations every weekend, and there's nothing to see. Something's not happening, and he's clearly much better than that. And we're seeing nothing. With all due respect to Franco, he says there's something to see, maybe in FP4, maybe in FP3, whatever, but never in Q1, and therefore never in the race, because he gets stuck in traffic and then sometimes often crashes out. So there is a lack of proper benchmarking for Fabio. I think that much is accurate, but it's also accurate that he's a stud.
So the sort of looking forward at Yamaha, there was a lot of talk over the weekend actually about sort of European influence in Japanese manufacturers that was started on Thursday by Marc Marquez, who came in and said in his sort of brief media session that he did with us on his 2-day return to the paddock, that part of the thing that needs to change with the team is that they need to change the concept of the team. And he was kind of implying that it needs to be a bit more European and a bit less Japanese in its thinking. And then Quartararo kind of backed him up by saying, oh, yeah, you know, Yamaha need to do the same. That's something that we're sort of most aware of, perhaps, in terms of aerodynamics, where they, you know, that's where there's the visible difference in the Japanese bikes and the European bikes these days. But there's also a bit of engine magic in it as well. And yeah, Yamaha have brought in a guy called Luca Marmarini, who is an ex-Ferrari and Toyota engine development boss, who has been, unsurprisingly, actually already dipping his toes in MotoGP with Aprilia, because obviously he would have been at Ferrari heading up their engine program whenever Aprilia boss Massimo Rivola was heading up the team. So there's obviously an old friendship there, and he's already come in and had a look at their engine. I think he's been there quite a bit longer than we thought, because they didn't actually announce that he'd arrived at the start, but they're obviously trying to do what they can to make things a bit easier for Quartararo on a straight line. And from what we understand, actually, the new bike, the first iteration of the 2023 bike, will be at Misano in a couple of weeks' time after the race there. There's a test, and I think Quartararo will have one, as well as obviously Cal Crutchlow.
I'm just reeling from the betrayal of me saying I wasn't going to go looking up Luca Marmarini's name, and then Simon mentioning it.
Having a European influence into a Japanese engine on a two-wheel Grand Prix motorcycle is actually nothing new. I walked past the back of the Yamaha truck some years ago, and there was about a cylinder head sized box, shall I say, and it came from St. James Mill Road in Northamptonshire, England. That's Cosworth. So, but that was some while ago, Valentino Fiat Yamaha days. So that's well out of date.
There's also been, Toby, you'll remember his name. Is it Herbie Blash?
Oh, yeah, of course I do. Yeah, I know him well. Yeah.
Who was an F1 engine builder who's still involved in Yamaha. I think he's got, like, kind of a senior role as kind of auditor for their race programs for Japan now, but he was involved in the Yamaha Formula One engine project, if I'm right.
Herbie Blash was a mechanic at Brabham when Bernie owned Brabham. Herbie Blash then, Brabham then had a Yamaha engine in the back of it. It was a big V12 thing. Bless it, never really worked. It was a bit of a big old bus. But Brabham then disappeared. They fizzled away as Bernie Eccleston then ran Formula One as the business rather than running a team as his business. But Herbie Odd had obviously kept some Yamaha connections, and they continue to this day, which is why we regularly see him in a World Superbike garage with Crescent. And he's always there. He was alongside Charlie Whiting in the Formula One race direction control room, and actually is kind of still back there as a consultant whilst they Formula One find their race direction feet again after the mess that happened in Abu Dhabi last year. So yeah, Herbie has a Yamaha eye, and there are a lot of clever people in Europe, particularly in the UK's Silicon Valley of motorsport, as I call it, around Silverstone, Banbury, such like, Northampton, that is a £10-12 billion operation on an annual basis. So there are a lot of clever people around there. Other people have come in to do some Formula One bits in engines, but that's been in the past, and we'll do that in a retro podcast. Not now. So, yeah, the Yamaha, it did pretty well yesterday with Quartararo in amongst the four Ducatis in the top five. And he did so well. Miller, yeah, third position for him. But he was pretty happy just to get to the finish because he's got a different psychology now at the moment, Simon.
Yeah, it very much seems that way, doesn't it? He admitted in... He admitted afterwards in the press conference that he was the goose to Pecco's Maverick, very much implying that he is the sort of the backseat tail gunner. Val did point out in our group chat afterwards that Top Gun didn't exactly end well for Goose.
Spoilers.
But I suppose there's a comparison to be made going to KTM, given how badly their day went yesterday for Miller. But I think the fact that he barely put a move on Bagnaia whenever I feel like he was probably capable of doing it, and also the fact that he was so offended afterwards by the move that Jorge Martin did put on him, kind of implies that to him there's a bit of a Ducati pecking order that must be obeyed now, even if there's not team orders as such. And as a result, I think it's probably going to limit his chances to win through the rest of the year if he's not really prepared to be aggressive against Bagnaia, because I think any weekend that you see Miller looking strong for the rest of the year, Bagnaia will be as strong or stronger. Sure. So, yeah.
Ultimate team player. Ultimate.
It's so impressive, and it's an impressive in a very unusual way, because like the lengths Jack will go to defend Pecco, despite the fact that Pecco is basically the guy who killed any chances of him being Ducati top dog. And couple that with the fact that Miller is leaving to KTM. So having, I think, effectively been more or less deemed surplus to requirements at Ducati, the fact that he's not rocking the boat in the least and staying such a committed team player, it's just... it's very impressive, and I think it probably points to a guy who has never been super sure of his future in MotoGP, and therefore understands the value of showing his loyalty to teams and of adding that selling point to whoever else will court him. That I'll go to bat for you when you're paying my wages, and I'll help your ultimate goals. But it also just really likes Pecco. And it came out, as Simon will remember, when Pecco was being grilled about the Ibiza thing in the summer, and Miller very publicly stuck up for him in the press conference. I didn't particularly appreciate or like what Miller said. I didn't think it made much sense. But I did find it interesting how loyal he's proven to Bagnaia. Again,
he stood in for his younger brother in a scrap, didn't he?
Basically, yeah. And again, remember, this younger brother, they're not blood related, whatever that counts for. But also that younger brother, I think the emergence of that younger brother has killed his chances of leading a Ducati title charge. And the fact that he doesn't hold that against Bagnaia at all, I think it's impressive. I am impressed. And it's a good thing.
And ironically, if there was a day to actually show Bagnaia a bit of aggression and to try and take the win off him, given that he's going to KTM next year, it was Sunday. It was at the Red Bull Ring, because that would have been something to give his employers for next year a little bit of hope. But he very much reverted to team player and did what he did. The question has to be now whether or not he expects to go to KTM as top dog, or whether he's going to fit into that same role with Brad Binder, which could mean even less chances to win. Because I think the days when the KTM will be good are going to be a lot less than the days when the Ducati are currently good next year. And we know that Binder is already the kind of favoured son at KTM. It's very difficult to see a world in which Miller comes in and takes that title off him. But it's also going to take a little bit of time to build a relationship with Brad to try and replicate that, because at the end of the day, because they came from Pramac together, this is him and Bagnaia's fourth season together.
Yeah.
They've spent a lot of time together.
And I think they do go a fair way back too in the junior categories. And I don't think there's that with Binder. It's sort of slightly different generations, even though there's not that big of an age gap, but just because of the past traveled. I think,
although they are neighbors.
Oh, that helps.
Yeah.
And that helps. Yeah. But I think, you know what? I don't think it'll come up much, because I don't think KTM will mind Jack lunging at Brad so much, because it'll be for 7th, 8th place. That's my feeling, initially at least. And then the dynamic will change if KTM moves forward.
KTM will say at the beginning of the year, they've said it now, actually, probably within their boardroom, which is just let them get on with it. Let them get on with it. They'll worry about the problem of the pair of them knocking each other off for first and second position on the last corner of the last lap when they get there. In the meantime, get to the front of the bloody race.
That's the thing. There is fundamentally not a world in which Miller goes to KTM next year as Bagnaia's wingman for a title championship, or Binder's wingman for a title championship.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen. Yeah. Like the bike's just not there yet.
Yeah. How about Paul's wingman? Paul's returning to the KTM bike, and he was quite good on it last time.
Yeah, but I genuinely think the bike has got worse since he left, not better.
Yeah, that's plausible.
Yeah, and anything that Paul doesn't ride that finishes 16th, he'll be happy with. Poor old Ennio Bastianini, we need to touch on him. He had a stellar pole position on Saturday afternoon, leading the race, ran on a bit, got to another big stop, ran on a bit. It came out that he had dinged the front wheel rim. So that meant it wasn't round. So then the bead wasn't sitting properly in the rim. And therefore there was a bit of air coming out of that front tyre. And that was the end of his race. That's a quirky finish to a race, a retirement that I've not seen in a proverbial 1,000 races. Quite bizarre.
Yeah, getting curb damage that ends your race is more of a Formula One thing than a MotoGP thing, certainly.
Or a road racing thing.
Yeah, fair enough.
High curbs in a road race circuit.
Yeah. But it's so obviously, it was a minor error, but clearly the punishment doesn't fit the crime in that case. But sometimes sometimes it just works out like that. The thing is, if I'm Ducati, I'm super annoyed at how the weekend went in terms of deciding who the teammate for Bagnaia is. It only gets harder. How does it keep getting harder? It's incomprehensible. So Bastianini, who doesn't qualify well, suddenly just decided to stick it on pole. Martin had good pace all weekend, but for some reason decided to chuck it down the inside of Miller and threw away a good result on the final lap. Nothing conclusive. If they make a decision after this and coming into Misano, that means their mind has already been made up, because this doesn't tell anybody anything new, I don't think. Apart from Bastianini qualifying much better than usual, but he's already been on the front row. So we know that that's occasionally possible. We don't know if it's consistently possible.
I disagree.
Ooh.
I think that this very much tipped the odds even further in Bastianini's favor, because he showed, you know, if you take what we saw of his weekend, he showed that he has improved his qualifying performance, which has always been something of a letdown. He was hanging in there at the front of the race and looking quite strong, and then something went wrong and we didn't get to see the potential of that. But he's a guy who gets faster as the race goes on.
Mm.
Whereas Jorge Martin's race weekend was a standard issue. Jorge Martin start really strong, cling on till the end as the tire faded because he's not very good at managing them. And then he went and did something really stupid that could have taken two Ducatis out of the podium fight, not just one. I think that to me showed that he's still quite rash, still quite, he doesn't think very sometimes about what he's going to do. He just does it. Bastianini looked like the wiser set of hands, the safer set of hands at the weekend. And let's, you know, remember, we're not necessarily looking, they're not looking for a Fabio Quartararo mm-hmm. here. They're not looking for someone to come and win a title. They're looking for someone to replace Jack Miller, who, as we've just talked about at great length, is an amazing, steady wingman backup number two. If their faith truly is in Bagnaia, then I think the last two race weekends massively counts against Martin, because at Silverstone, he damaged another Ducati, Bastianini, with an aggressive move. And then this weekend, he nearly wiped out a Ducati with another aggressive move.
Let me rephrase what I meant, because I think the case you laid out there is pretty ironclad. But I also agree that Bastianini has had the better weekend. But I also, the problem there for me is that Bastianini has had the better season by the same kind of margin. That's for me the problem. And what if I were Ducati, I would be absolutely just praying to see a weekend in which one of the guys destroys the other and makes an ironclad case so that whoever you snub can't get mad. I think, honestly, I think they want Martin in that ride. That's sort of my feeling. And I think it's becoming increasingly hard to justify it to Bastianini to promote Martin, while at the same time, I don't think Martin is seeing it as the case being made. It's like neither rider will be convinced that they might not deserve the ride after this. Both riders will be still like, yeah, it's mine. I deserve it.
Of course they don't. They're riders.
Yeah.
Essentially, what Val is saying is that Ducati's life would have been so much easier if Martin had taken out Miller.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, but arguably, Val, Martin did...
A la Iannone in 2014.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
When he got sacked for taking out Dobby.
Ain't that the truth? But arguably, Val, Martin did make a horlicks of it, because all he had to do with, what was it, a lap and a bit to go, was just get it to the line. And he screwed it up. Get it to the line. And, you know, he came across the line in 10th, not, what would he have got? Third. Anyway. Well, we've got a whole podcast on that because we did it last week. So, end of subject.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
One of the stars at the Red Bull Ring in 2022, who hardly got any TV coverage, hardly any mentions throughout the race. I felt a bit sorry for him, but his best result ever in MotoGP. And as a satellite rider, a private rider, fourth position, Luca Marini on the Mooney VR46 Ducati. Best of the rest behind Bagnaia, Quartararo and Miller. Utterly under the radar. Utterly under the radar. And if anybody had a good day on a Ducati who wasn't Bagnaia, it was Marini. And there we were at the beginning of the race thinking it was going to be Bastianini or Martin. It was Marini. Brilliant.
Yep. Absolutely great ride with an awful lot of overtaking done. Because he kind of fluffed up qualifying and ended up P13, didn't make it to Q2. And then just, like you say, just out of nowhere, the Red Bull Ring has the best timing screens of the year because it's a giant wall of monitors at the front of the room. So it's one of the races where it's very easy to keep a track of people and their movements and whatever. And I didn't even see him, even in the timing screens. He was just there. There was almost no TV coverage of him. There was almost nothing. And then suddenly he was just P4. Really, really impressive. Something that's came at a good time, going to Misano, which is a track that he knows as well as Enea Bastianini. And let's not forget that it's where Bastianini had those breakthrough podiums last year. And I think for Marini to go there next weekend and consider a podium as a realistic option wouldn't be crazy.
I'd argue that the timing is also nice because obviously the VR46 guy that might one day take his ride, Celestino Vietti, did a big dent to his Moto2 title hopes in the race prior by crashing out while chasing after second. But nah, it doesn't really matter, does it? Because it's Marini's ride for 2023 and we know he's capable of this kind of race, even though this is his best result in MotoGP yet. It's broadly similar to some of the races we've seen before. It's just whether that can be channeled more often, which will you know, again, Misano is a good time to show that we can go two in a row.
Well, he's got the home race dilemma, hasn't he? He's either going to fly or he's going to mess it up, but probably the first racetrack he ever rode on. Simon?
Just to add to the he may well mess it up thing, they did sort of let it slip at the weekend that they have unleashed the ultimate curse upon themselves and will be running a special livery for Misano.
Yeah, but at least it'll be cool. At least it'll be cool, Simon, for crying out loud.
That's true. That's true. That's
oh, ye of little faith.
He'll look good as he crashes out.
Don't.
No, I'm not saying he's going to crash out. But the problem with that is that I don't really think it's possible for anyone on a satellite bike to kind of be consistently top six anymore, because it's just so wild in MotoGP at the minute and things change about so much. And you know, every time we see someone kind of look like they're going to string together two or three races there, they get dunted back and someone else is there to do the same thing, be it Marini, be it Bezzecchi, Bastianini, Martin, Zarco. Even on occasion this year, it's kind of looked like Nakagami or Marquez might be able to kind of, you know, it's such a fluid championship at the minute that I think if you're a third tier satellite rider, which he is arguably, then I think the occasional top five or top six and the odd chance to fight for a podium over the course of a season is a good year.
Okay, so Marini in fourth, Johann Zarco in fifth position, but let's talk about Aleix Espargaró's sixth position aboard the Aprilia. By the way, quick mention to it was Lorenzo Savadori who was racing in a retro 1985 Aprilia colour scheme, the kind
beautiful
of thing that Maurice Reggiani would race on a 250 at Misano. I mean, just fantastic. But rose-tinted spectacles back in their box. Aleix Espargaró, still riding injured after that Silverstone high side, ankle still hurting. However, couldn't get the launch control, couldn't get the start system all sorted. What did he have to say about that? Why couldn't he engage?
It failed for the second time the weekend. Says he had it didn't fail before at any point in the season, but it for whatever reason, it failed twice at the Red Bull Ring. But he also, the way he put it is it didn't really matter. And I think he's correct in that assessment, because looking back at it, he goes a few places back at the start, obviously, but all of those places are made up one way or another through the rest of the first lap. So by the start of lap two, he's sending it down the inside of Luca Marini into turn one for what I think is already seventh place at that point. It was a good race and the best of bad circumstances, but it's the sort of thing that really makes you doubt how feasible this title challenge is if there are going to be weekends like this for Aprilia, given the amount of points he needs to make up. Again, it's a really good race because he rather comprehensively outperformed Vinales, despite, I think, Vinales having looked marginally the quicker Aprilia for so much of the weekend. So getting it done on Sunday, I think Aleix did get the points haul that was available to him, but that's... like, I'm not sure that's enough when you're trailing 30 to somebody who's as relentless as Fabio with seven to go. So it's a good race, it was a good effort, but it doesn't leave me very optimistic for the title.
The only good thing about it is I think it's probably the last circuit this year where he's going into the weekend expecting not to do well, because Misano, they test endlessly at and know it very well. Aragon's one of his favourite circuits where he always goes really well. The overseas races are unknowns to an extent, but if there's not an Aprilia, at least one Aprilia on the podium at Phillip Island, something has gone horribly wrong. So I think he's had his duff weekend, but he can't have another now. But I think he's quite aware of that. And I should say, you mentioned the ankle hurting Toby. We know Aleix is a pretty tough character. The only time he actually mentioned his ankle hurting all weekend was on Saturday afternoon. He's obviously quite an opinionated guy. He had strong opinions in sprint races and rider unions on Friday. He obviously got his wrist slapped along with a few others on Saturday morning. And when I asked him again about unions on Saturday afternoon, he announced, "My ankle's hurting, I have to go now. Thanks, guys," and laughed.
Oh, dear. Yes, yes. Okay, so Aleix in sixth, as you say, Val, you can't mount a championship challenge when you're finishing sixth when the bloke you're battling is winning three races on the trot. Not a hometown victory for KTM in 2022. Brad Binder taking seventh position, teammate Miguel Oliveira in 12th position. Kind of a very 2022 result, is it not, Simon?
Yeah, and actually, I think they're probably the manufacturer who has suffered the most, or not even who has suffered the most, who's kind of, no one really seemed to win or lose too much from the new layout of the Red Bull Ring, apart from KTM, because the problem that they're struggling with is that sort of slow corner acceleration traction, and they just lost so much out of the new turn two chicane every time that they kind of pinned that as one of the big issues, or the big issue of the weekend. It's kind of bizarre given how strong they have been here in the past, but you know, it shows just how much that bike is evolving and how much they're struggling with it.
Now, you say KTM's the one that's been sort of the big change in performance, but we've also seen Suzuki a lot better at the Red Bull Ring in recent years than this year. Like, a lot better.
But we've also seen Suzuki a lot better in recent years than the debacle that is their 2022 season as a whole. So,
yeah, I guess. But even so, I think just because it was so good at the Red Bull Ring, particularly in recent years, and this time it didn't look better than the other tracks. It looked probably a little bit worse. So, it's... that one's a little bit weird because you'd think the fast change of direction in that new chicane would be okay for it, but didn't really seem to do much of anything. Apart from launch John Muir into space coming out of turn four in the opening lap.
That was like an 800cc era high side. That's the biggest four-stroke high side I've seen in such a long time.
It's Lorenzo Shanghai 2008.
Yeah.
Came down with snow on him. Terrifying. Did they... Silly me asking a question. Did they offer an explanation as to why it happened? Because that's a very strange off.
No, but I think... You've got to put a bit of the blame on a cold tire, don't you?
I think early
in the race, yeah. Pushing. He knew he had to push early in the race, and he was. Yeah. And I think that just he asked a little bit too much. It's not the sort of thing that you would have expected of Joan Mir a few years ago, but at the minute it's kind of, you know, asking too much from the bike and going down is kind of par for the course of his 60 DNFs so far this season.
Mm. Is there a question mark for Misano?
Is there a question for Misano? Depends on what we'll find out later on Monday when he gets back to Barcelona and goes for an MRI scan of his ankle to see what ligament damage he's done as well as bone damage. But if he isn't fit for Misano, Suzuki have a real problem because test rider Sylvain Contoli is still also broken from his Suzuki at our testing crash. So either we have one bike in the grid or they end up drafting in a random.
I should say... There should be a question mark for Misano, but I should also say that, honestly, this is such a mean thing to say, and I'm really kind of mad at myself for propagating it, even after it's come out that Joan is seriously hurt, that it wasn't just a minor tip-off, that it was a really, really nasty crash. But I just don't want to see him on that bike anymore. I don't understand what we're doing here with this. He's basically, it's like he swapped minds with the Alex Rins of 2021, but there's no light at the end of the tunnel because nothing is happening. This season is over. It is over. Nothing will be achieved. Yeah. There is no point to any of this. You've won your title with Suzuki. Suzuki has what it could have ever asked for from you. Take it easy and try to think about what you can do.
Yeah, it's really difficult when they're on the bike Honda. And the visor's down. They're racers. Yeah, I know what you're saying, Val, but you and I would be the same if we were there. Oh, go on, I've got a chance today. I can do it. Whoop, up you go.
It's not even that, I think. I think that, weirdly, some people expected the Suzuki withdrawal to bring the riders' loyalty into doubt. And what it's actually done, it's almost doubled down on it.
Yeah.
Because they have no loyalty whatsoever now to Japan, but Rins and Mir love their team. And I think it's perhaps misguided loyalty to that sort of cohort of 40 people that travel around the world with them every weekend that are keeping them there and keeping them fighting so hard. Which, if you've ever been in with the Suzuki team in hospitality or whatever, you understand it. They're a really close bunch. They're you know, we've talked about this at length in the Brivio era about how he built a factory team that feels like a family team, and that atmosphere remains.
Doesn't it ever?
I don't know about contractually, but it's not misguided loyalty because obviously those are people you care about, and that's very important. That's the most important. But I don't think they're gonna be much better off by you finishing fifth instead of seventh or whatever. Because that bike is not winning races this year. But also, I think they're probably a little bit more concerned about where they're going to work next year, more than whether you finish fifth or sixth or seventh. I know this is not how race teams work necessarily. I know that when it's the weekend, everybody super hard pulling towards the same goal. And I get that. And for as long as Joan Mir is in Suzuki colors, I admire him trying as hard as he can in every practice and every qualifying and every race, even though I don't think his mind is quite right now. I think it's hit him really hard what's been happening, but also I think it's a matter for between the weekends. Like, there's no benefit from any of this. I'm sorry, there's nothing.
I'll be honest, from what I've heard from inside the Suzuki camp, it's not a case of we get together the weekend and we stop worrying about job hunting and we've become a great team and we go racing again. There is, you know, they're not on 100%. They're not the team they were because of the way that things are going on and what's going on around them. You know, and Mir kind of hinted at the weekend that one of the stumbling blocks in finalising the Honda deal, I'm still certain he's going to Honda, and I'm sure there's like a letter of intent or something that has been signed, but there's not a contract yet. And part of that seems to be trying to figure out what room there are at Honda for Suzuki staff, because he's desperate to give those guys a chance to stay in the paddock too. Because of that loyalty to them,
and then you bump somebody out of Honda, and round it goes.
Yeah, And Mir actually mentioned that, which is very impressive. This is a young man who has the presence of mind to realize that as much as he wants to keep his crew together, he's also not interested in getting people out of jobs at Honda, which is an easy thing to realize, but I don't think it's something that every writer would think about or publicly address.
Yeah, no, I should clarify that whenever I said trying to make room for guys at Honda, he is literally trying to make room for them in creating, it feels like he's trying to create new roles for them rather than see anyone sacked. You know, that guy.
Yeah, he's not stupid. I mean, this poor old Suzuki thing, it's a bit like, I don't know, dying, but still being around to read your obituary in all the papers.
Yeah. It really is.
Yeah, it's just the longest drawn out thing, but we've touched on that in the past. Okay. Only one Honda of four scored, 2 points at the Red Bull Ring in 2022, and that went to Alex Marquez, Pol Espargaro in 16th, standing rider for Marc Marquez, Stefan Bradl in 17th. Taka Nakagami had an off, didn't finish the Grand Prix. Marc Marquez did turn up to the Grand Prix, though, to show his face, show his hands, meet sponsors, guide the team. guide the team? Crikey. If he's a speedboat trying to push an oil tanker, he's got a lot of work to do.
I imagine he didn't care too much about the outcome of the weekend, but it did sort of convey the impression to me, not of an injured rider reuniting with his team, but, and I've said this multiple times in written pieces, I think, but it had the impression of a corporate bigwig showing up with his hands behind his back, you know, sort of walking around, assessing what's going on, seeing which bits need to change, which bits need to cut, where the budget is better redeployed. I don't know how fair that is, but I think there was an unmistakable aura of that in his media address and just in his presence. This is still a guy who is Honda. Even if John Mir is coming in, this is still the man.
But man, things look bad. Like, they are... To extend your metaphor, Toby, I think Suzuki and Honda are kind of two patients with a terminal diagnosis, except one has made peace with that and the other, you know, I can't comprehend how badly things have gone wrong at Honda. It's beyond belief at this point that we're watching two Repsol Hondas cruise around in 16th and 17th because the bike is so bad.
And it was a podium bike.
Yeah.
At the start of the season.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Like, how has this gone so wrong? And, you know, there are fresh rumors this weekend of new blood coming in to sort of lead the way. And, like, of course there is, because how are heads not rolling in Japan and in Barcelona, where the team are headquartered, for this debacle? It's just... It's beyond belief. And I don't think Marc Marquez turning up for 3 days and looking at everything that's going on is going to fix anything. There's no way it is. And the only rider that scored any points for them is the one that they've sacked.
Yeah. Can you imagine, you know, a Mercedes AMG Formula One team, and then within about a year being unable to even score a point in Formula One? I'm sure you've got a football analogy, Val, of a mega team, and then they're at the top of the Premiership, they win everything, and then they're in Division 2 in 12 months, just like that.
Yeah, I watched my football team crap the bed against Leeds yesterday, so I'm not really... I'd rather not.
But this isn't your football team getting beaten, Val. This is your football team getting relegated. This is Chelsea getting relegated.
All right, well,
that's where we
don't
are.
Don't use now. Those words. Thanks.
We are one Paul Espargaro result away from discussing the possibility of Honda getting concession status in MotoGP for the second time in 3 years.
Yeah.
It's wild.
I never thought of that, Simon. Holy smoke. I saw a stat earlier today, and it was about the 1997 season. Now, I know that's a gazillion years ago, and let's park that for a minute. But Repsol Honda won every Grand Prix. Every single race. And then, of course, in recent history, we've had Mark do unbelievable things, and oh, how we miss him. Now he's gone. And here they are. They're tugging at the back, and it's just...
You want to talk about a gazillion years ago, Toby? Someone told me, I haven't fact-checked it, so I might not be wrong, but it feels right. Someone told me at the weekend that this is their longest run without a podium since 1982.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. So that was the NR, which was nicknamed Never Ready.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, what to say? It's a bit of a mess. We're going to touch on riders going where in 2023. We're going to look at that in next week's podcast. That's what we were lining up to do there. And of course, the other news is about sprint races that came through at the weekend. Simon and Val did a podcast that went out on Saturday evening. If you go through wherever you get your podcasts from, it's the podcast before the one you are listening to now. Many of you will have read and listened to opinions. My comment would be that 44 races over a season is just kind of taking the shine off the Grand Prix Premier class. These riders are held in stratospheric regard by all of the fans and all of the sporting world. So to use them for more GPs without consulting them is a little bit of a mess. But it is what it is, and it's going to happen. Are riders going to risk a lot for half the amount of points when double the amount of points are on offer the day after? If you're a tail ender, then why push? Teams get their start money for starting a race, but in theory, at the back of the grid, once you've started the race, you get your start money, and that's the business side of things. And I know that I do drift onto that. But if you're not going to be in the points, then, well, you know, what you're doing. I watched a sprint race at Silverstone Formula One last year. I thought it was a bit flat, but I'm not comparing completely apples with apples because that's Formula One, not MotoGP. However, I've always thought that on a Saturday afternoon, the FP4 was a little bit of a waste of time. I think it was too long. It was too long in that slot before qualifying. But what it did do was get eyeballs to watch logos on TV for another 40 minutes or so, so that sponsors got their money's worth. Dorna have snuck that sunrise in past the rooster for many a year. So now filling it with a Grand Prix, a race, is arguably better than FP4. But whether or not it's the answer is another story. However, there's an expression in live show world when you're on stage, which is sometimes people turn up and go, oh, just turn the volume up, just turn it up. Just making it louder doesn't make it better. There's no mini small Le Mans 24 hour. There's no mini Suzuka 8 hour or 4 hour. There's no Olympic Games light, is there? These crowning events are sacrosanct and they're held up high. And I feel the same about the Grand Prix on the Sunday. Personally, and we touched on this, didn't we, guys, the other day, I would change the race times. I think it's a cheap and easy thing to do because TV is king. No TV, no sponsors. We're club racing, aren't we? Sunday night races, Monday night races, as we did in Qatar in 2009. Try it, guys. Just give it a go. Why does there always have to be a Grand Prix in the middle of the afternoon? Arguably, that's a hangover from catering to the fans' trackside in the 1950s, in the 1960s, before live TV had been invented. But with TV king now, we can move things around in some other way. But as maybe you've touched on before, Simon, and in the articles that you've got on the website, you know, TV figures at the moment are low and we've got to get things out of it. We've got to hurry them up. We've also got to hurry up the TV coverage because between the end of the race in Austria and the first time we spoke to the winner in Parc Fermé, it was 13 minutes. In TV world, that's a century because people click away. A riders' union has been mentioned. I'm all for that. And it's an idea that is fantastic. But ultimately, there'll be a clause in the deal that the riders sign between the FIM and Dorna that mean that whatever the riders, if the riders really kick back, they'd have to do it as a union. Nobody can go off and do their own thing, which is what happened at the Misano race in something like late 80s. And Pier Francesco Chili won the race because he went against the union. Fundamentally, though, of course, in a Grand Prix, if a rider doesn't like it and he doesn't ride, he doesn't get his points and he doesn't get paid. And that's never going to happen because we all know what they're like. This Grand Prix on a Saturday is going to happen. But personally, I think it devalues things because sometimes less is actually more. Because if you drink champagne all of the time, what do you drink to celebrate? I don't know if there was stuff in there that you touched on in your podcast, and I'm sure there's been another bit of thinking now since the Saturday afternoon, guys, since the announcement was made. But it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Let's see how it does shake out. There is a glimmer, Simon and Val, that they might change it between now and the first race next year in Portugal. There might be a little bit of wiggle room. Let's see. That's happened before.
Yeah, I might change it there. I think they were still changing it between Friday and Saturday, I think, or between Saturday and Sunday, one of the two, in that where they made the U-turn on the decision on whether or not sprint race wins would count as GP wins, which... The more I think about, the more I realize I have no strong opinion about. I don't know, but it's weird to have it all announced and firmed up, and yet still up for debate. But hey,
that's a direct consequence of announcing the biggest shakeup in the sport's 73-year history without consulting any of the people involved in it.
Yeah,
I mean. This has all been about the big, as we said in the podcast the other day, it's all been about the big flashy Hollywood announcement this weekend. And I think an element of that, based on how defensive and aggressive the press conference was that it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. When the sensible strategy would have been announcing 6 weeks ago that you were thinking about it and launching a working group involving the riders, the teams, the factories, the media, the TV, the blah, 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 blah. Didn't happen.
But the announcement's been made, and naturally not many people like change. We all get into a rhythm, we all like what we like, but let's see how it all pans out. Let's see how it all pans out. But do go back and listen to what Val and Simon have got to say about it on the day with their podcast, the one before the one you are looking at. 13 Grand Prix down, 7 to go. We've got Misano, Aragon, Bateki, Thailand, Phillip Island, Sepang, Valencia. Keep in touch with the-race.com for all of your motorsport news. In the meantime, we look forward to next week where we'll catch up with some of your listeners' questions and also who is going where in 2023. From Val, Simon and myself, Toby, speak to you all soon.
The Athletic.